silent night, holy night. All is calm, all is bright, round young woman whose sexual status is none of your business. Hello, this is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice, and I'm here with
Heather
and Elizabeth.
Today, we will be talking about a holiday that you probably don't think has anything to do with feminism. Maybe you also think it's deeply rooted in a very patriarchal religion, very male-centered traditions, celebrating a male god. Yes, it is December. We are obviously talking about Christmas. Because in the course of our research, it turned out that not all Christmas traditions or winter celebrations or festivities stem from the celebration of male deities. Because today we'll talk about Christmas traditions, winter celebrations that celebrate female mythological figures or winter goddesses, so that you don't have to celebrate a sun you don't believe in, of a god you don't believe in, but instead, after this episode maybe, you can celebrate feminismus instead of Christmas. So did you, for example, know that Christmas caroling is actually a remnant of pre-Christian fertility rites when villagers traveled through the fields and orchards in the middle of winter, and they were singing and shouting to drive away any spirits that might inhibit the growth of their future crops, or that kissing under the mistletoe also refers back to a fertility ritual, and that the mistletoe itself is closely associated with the Norse goddess of love, Frigga. Heather's going to tell you a bit about that later. Or that the Christmas tree, or rather its popularization within the Anglophone world, happened due to a woman, Queen Victoria. In 1848, she encouraged her German husband, Prince Albert, to put up a tree in their house, just as he had done when he was a child. And that year, homes throughout England featured the Christmas tree as the latest fashion. And as you may know, less than 50 years later, there was a Christmas tree in the White House. So essentially, one woman popularized the Christmas tree in the English-speaking world. However, there are plenty of other interesting female figures and December celebrations that are interesting from a feminist perspective. And one of those is St. Lucia, and Liz is going to tell you a bit about that.
St. Lucia was a young Christian girl who was martyred and killed for her faith in the year 304, so fucking forever ago. The most common story told about St. Lucia, or St. Lucy, as some she's often called, is that she would secretly bring food to persecuted Christians in Rome who lived in hiding in the catacombs under the city. So she was awesome. She was amazing. She did all these amazing things. And she would wear candles on her head so that she had both of her hands free to carry things. And Lucy means light, so this is a like super appropriate name for her. So her feast day is December 13th, which is also winter solstice, the shortest day of the year in the old Julian calendar. And the pagan festival of lights in Sweden was turned into St. Lucia Day. St. Lucia Day is now celebrated by young girls dressing in a white dress with a red sash around her waist and a crown of candles on her head. And it's kind of like a female version of St. Nicholas Day. Like, instead of celebrating a fat man who brings you presents, you celebrate an awesome woman, girl, who brought people food, which is kind of awesome.
So this reminds me of someone I found on Facebook. Her name's Jana Yinton. It's spelled with J, like Jana Jinton, but I'm sure it's pronounced Jana Yinton. Anyway, she has a Facebook page, and she's well known for kalning, which is an ancient Swedish herding call. It's beautiful. Anyway, just a few days ago, she actually posted a video of her walking through the woods. It's just snow everywhere, and she's in a long white gown with, I think, a red scarf, and she has a crown on her head with actual burning candles, and as she's going through the woods, there are candles lighting her way. So I should probably, link that to our Facebook page, but I just want to throw that out there. I thought that that looked cool, especially the crown part.
Yeah. So the crown is made actually of lingonberry branches, which are kind of evergreen, and they symbolize new life in the winter. Schools normally have their own St. Lucia or each individual town will have like their own St. Lucia. And some towns and villages choose a girl to play her in the procession where carols are sung. A national Lucia is also chosen, and she visits hospitals and old folks' homes, singing songs about St. Lucia and handing out pepperkakor, which are like ginger snap biscuits, which I assume are kind of like, not pfeffernusse, but just like ginger cookies. So small children sometimes like to dress up as St. Lucia with the help of their parents, and also boys might dress up as Stjärngossar, maybe? Star boys. And the girls might be Tjärnor, like Lucia, but without the candles. So they have opportunities for boys and girls to participate. So the day became like first widely celebrated in Sweden in the late 1700s. St. Lucia Day is also celebrated in Denmark, Norway, Finland, Bosnia, and Croatia, and in a lot of Swedish communities outside of Sweden. I have a friend from college whose family is Swedish, and they still participate in a St. Lucia Day in their community, and both of her girls will dress up as Lucia and all of that. It's very cute. In Denmark, it's more of a children's day, and in some parts of Italy, children are told that St. Lucy brings them presents, and they leave out a sandwich for her and the donkey that helps her carry the gifts. So, again, it's a lot like St. Nicholas, or Santa Claus in the United States. Like, you leave out cookies and for the girl who's bringing you gifts, and the donkey, apparently, as well. All the details of her life are the conventional ones associated with female martyrs of the early 4th century. and John Henry Blount views her story as a Christian romance similar to the acts of other, like, virgin martyrs. So according to the traditional story, Lucy was born of rich and noble parents about 283. Her father was of Roman origin, but died when she was 5 years old, leaving Lucy and her mother without a protective guardian, which... Heather, maybe you can speak to this. In like the second century, like that was probably not awesome to not have a protective guardian.
Yeah, things were a little crazy. Literally. Literally crazy.
So her mother, her mother's name seems to indicate that they were Greek, of Greek origin. And like many of the early martyrs, Lucy had consecrated her virginity to God, and she hoped to distribute her dowry to the poor, which she seems pretty, pretty awesome. However, her mother, not knowing of her promise to distribute her dowry to the poor and consecrate her virginity to God, who was also suffering from a bleeding disorder, feared for Lucy's future, and she arranged for a marriage to a young man of a wealthy pagan family. Now, this kind of shit happens a lot, I feel like, to virgin martyrs. They get promised to some dude, and they don't want to be married to the guy. Sometimes he's abusive. Ultimately, they end up, you know, dying, and they are often incorruptibles. Their bodies don't decay, and they're like, oh, they're saints, or they do something really, you know, miraculously wonderful, and they get declared as saints. So I see this going down a bad path, but let's continue. They went to the tomb of St. Agatha. St. Agatha had been martyred 52 years earlier in another persecution. Her shrine is kind of less than 50 miles from Syracuse and attracted a number of pilgrims. And many miracles were reported to have happened through her intercession. You pray to St. Agatha, she makes shit happen for you. So Lucy's mother was persuaded to make a pilgrimage to there in hopes of curing her bleeding disorder. While there, St. Agatha came to Lucy in a dream and told her that because of her faith, her mother would be cured and that Lucy would be the glory of Syracuse, as St. Agatha was of Catania. And I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, and I'm sorry, but her mother was miraculously cured, and Lucy took the opportunity to persuade her mother to allow her to distribute a good part of her riches among the poor. Her mother suggested that, like, the dowry would make a good bequest, but Lucy said, quote, whatever you give away at death for the Lord's sake, you give because you cannot take it with you. Give now to the true Savior while you are healthy, whatever you intend to give away at your death. So you can't take it with you, people. Give away your money to poor people. Amazing. News that her dowry and jewels were being distributed got back to Lucy's fiance, who denounced her. And the governor of Syracuse, whose name I'm not going to be able to pronounce, but that's fine, ordered her to burn in sacrifice to the emperor's image because she was giving shit to the poor. When she refused she ordered her to burn a sacrifice, not herself in sacrifice, but I think we know where this is going. When she refused to burn the sacrifice, he sentenced her to be defiled in a brothel. Yeah, let's rape the virgin who's giving away all of these things to poor people because she's not willing to abide by my religion. The Christian tradition, like the Christian story, states that when the guards came to take her away, they couldn't move her even when they hitched her to a team of oxen. So they were like trying to pull her away, but she was like, she stood fast in her space. Bundles of wood were then heaped around her, and I think we know where this is going, ladies. The wood was set on fire, but she would not burn because she was so pure and good.
Or maybe she was a witch.
Or maybe she... Hey.
That's a possibility.
Entirely possible. Mm. So finally she met her death by the sword. So they just like stuck her with a sword and killed her.
They were like, something has to work. Let's try this.
It's like when they tried to kill Rasputin. They're like, he's not dying by poisoning. Let's try this. So in these early narratives and traditions, at least until the 15th century, we don't have the story of Lucia being tortured by eye gouging. But according to later accounts, before she died, she foretold the punishment of the governor of Syracuse and the speedy end of the persecution, adding that, the people would no longer reign and that Maximilian would meet his end. Anyway, this really angered the governor of Syracuse, and he ordered that the guards remove her eyes, which also fucking horrific. And another version has Lucy taking her own eyes out in order to discourage a persistent suitor who admired her. So instead of going with this dude, she just gouged her eyes out.
That's also a way of getting rid of a fuckboy.
Yeah, I mean, just disfigure yourself. It's fine, ladies.
It's not, but go on.
No. Anyway, so when her body was prepared for burial in the family mausoleum, it was discovered that her eyes had been miraculously restored.
Again, which...
Clearly. So, I mean, there's some, like, problematic things with the Lucy story, not the least of which is that she was a young girl who was a virgin who was forcibly raped because she wouldn't do things that the governor of her, area wanted her to do. And that, arranged marriages, blah, blah, blah. But that's pretty common for that time period. Not the rape necessarily, but maybe. But if we look at her as a young girl who is willing to give up everything in order to help the poor, I think that, she's the Christmas saint that we've all been hoping for.
But Lucia is not the only female figure that's celebrated at and around Christmas. So in Italy, for example, La Befana delivers gifts to children on Epiphany Eve, which is the night of January the 5th. So she's kind of comparable to Santa Claus or Saint Nicholas. And many believe that the word Befana derives from an Italian mispronunciation of the Greek Epiphania. So traditionally, La Befana visits all the children to fill their socks with candy and presents if they are good, or she fills them with coal or dark candy if they're bad. And in poorer parts of Italy, for example, in rural Sicily, a stick was placed in the stockings instead of coal. La Befana is also depicted as a good housekeeper who sweeps the floor before she leaves. And sometimes the sweeping of the floor is also interpreted as a metaphor for the sweeping away of the problems of the year that's now ending. So, and also the families often leave a glass of wine and a bit of food for the Befana. It's also interesting that she's usually portrayed as a rag, riding a broomstick through the air and wearing a black shawl. She's covered in soot because she enters the children's houses through the chimneys, which is also something that reminds us of someone else, right? But she's essentially a Christmas witch, and she's also referred to as such. She incorporates a number of pre-Christian traditions and figures such as the Alpine Perchta, whom I'm going to talk about a bit later. And she even can be traced back to Neolithic beliefs and practices, from where she developed into a goddess associated with fertility and agriculture before she then turned into today's Christmas witch. And there are also several Christian legends about the Bifana. So there's one that has it that Bifana was approached by the three wise men, or the three kings, a few days before the birth of the infant Jesus. And they ask her for directions to where they want to know where the son of God is, because they saw the star in the sky, but Bifana doesn't know. But she provides them with shelter for a night, because she was considered the best housekeeper in the village. So she has a very pleasant home. And then the three wise men invite her to join them on the journey to find baby Jesus, but she declines. And the reason why she declines is that she's too busy with her housework, obviously.
I was going to say, she had too much cleaning to do, obviously.
Yeah, she can't just go on a journey to see God. I mean, seriously, what are you thinking?
She's got sweeping to do, for fuck's sake.
This girl has shit to do. But then later she has a change of heart because she tries to find the three men and Jesus, but she's not able to find them. So up to this day, La Bifana is searching for the little baby, and she leaves all the good children toys and candy or fruit while the bad children get coal. And there's another legend that is a bit darker. And it has La Bifana as an ordinary woman with a child that she really loved. However, the child dies, and the resulting grief maddens her. And she hears that there is a child born called Jesus. And then she sets out to see him. And she's completely delusional because she thinks it's her son, her lost son. And she eventually meets Jesus. She gives him presents and gifts to make him happy. And the infant Jesus is delighted, and so he gave La Bifana a gift in return, and the gift is that she is the mother of every child in Italy. And then there's also another commonly heard legend that La Bifana starts the time of the birth of baby Jesus. So she spends her days cleaning and sweeping. And one day, the three wise men come to her door in search of baby Jesus. She turns them away because she's too busy cleaning. But then Bifana herself notices the bright light in the sky. And she thinks that, wait a minute, that might be the way to the baby Jesus that I just heard about. Then she brings some baked goods and gifts for baby Jesus in her bag. She takes a broom to help the new mother clean and begins her search for baby Jesus. So she searches for a long time, but she doesn't find him. And Bifana still searches today after all of these centuries. And on the eve of the Epiphany, Bifana comes to a house where there is a child and leaves a gift. And although she's been unsuccessful in her search, she still leaves gifts for the good children, because the Christ child can be found in all children. Aww.
I like this connection with Epiphany, because we don't usually give gifts on Epiphany in the United States, even though it's like the 12 days of Christmas is the whole like fucking like time after Christmas that leads up to Epiphany. But I like this tradition of like, first of all, I'm all for extending holidays as long as humanly possible. So if we can start the Christmas season basically at St. Nicholas Tag, or maybe Krampus Tag, like the day before, right, December 5th, into Epiphany, so we just keep it going, like the whole month of December into January, and I can just say, well, it's La Bifana's fault. She's still searching.
Liz, you would have done well in Rome with the whole holiday thing. They had holidays all the time, like just about every week if you look up different different calendars, like Ovid. It seems like just about every week they had a different type of festival for somebody.
I get behind that. My birthday is essentially an entire month. And my husband and I, in the fall, because my birthday is in September and his is in October, and then we've got Halloween and then Thanksgiving. Basically, the whole fall is treat season for us, and we just do all sorts of enjoyable, fun activities. So I think I was born far too late and really should have been a Roman. But maybe not like a virgin Roman who was going to get like murdered.
Well, I guess it depends. I mean, if you're a Roman like St. Lucia there that was coming up in the pagan world at the end, right when Christianity is starting to make a rise, and you take your stand as Christian, then
you're kind of
that's not a
fucked.
Good time.
Yeah,
that's not a good time on your end.
Or you just have to be very opportunistic and just believe in whatever people tell you to believe in and do what they tell, what they say. Then you'll be fine. Okay, so since we already talked a bit about Krampus, right? Liz said that it's on the 5th of December. I'm going to talk about something else that is kind of related to the idea of Krampus too. So, and what I'm going to talk about is the Pächter, or Berta, which is also commonly known as Pächt and various other variations. The Pächter was once known as a goddess in Alpine paganism in the Upper German and Austrian regions of the Alps, which is basically where I come from. Austria. I don't grew up in the Alps, but I come from Austria, so I'm very familiar with the idea of Pächt. Okay, so and the name Pächt is probably related to the name Pächtentag or Berchtentag, which is the feast of the Epiphany. So again, we have the tradition of celebrating Epiphany. And Pächter is often identified as stemming from the same Germanic goddess as Holda, which I'm also going to talk about a little later. Pächter is Holda's southern cousin or equivalent. And they both share the role of guardian of beasts, and they appear during the 12 days of Christmas when they oversee spinning. And Jakob Grimm also stated that Pächter was known, quote, precisely in those Upper German regions where Holda leaves off, in Swabia, I can't pronounce it in English. How do you pronounce it?
Elsass.
Okay, so Krim says that the Pächter was known, quote, precisely in those upper German regions where Holda leaves off, in Swabia, Elsass, in Switzerland, Bavaria, and in Austria. So,
hold on a second. When we're talking about upper German, so we often think about like north being up and south being down, but in Germany, because it goes from very flat lands in the north to like the Alps in the south, upper German regions are in the south rather than in the north.
Interesting.
Erika Timm said that the Pächter emerged from an amalgamation of Germanic and pre-Germanic, probably Celtic traditions of the Alpine regions after the migration period in the early Middle Ages. In some descriptions, the Pächter has two different forms. So she may either appear as a beautiful and white, a snow-like figure, or as elderly and haggard. So in some descriptions, Pächter has two forms. So she either appears as a beautiful white woman, who's very like snow-like. And in that case, she's called the Schönpächt, like the beautiful Pächt. Schön is beautiful. Or she's depicted as elderly and haggard. In that case, she's the Schirrpächt, the ugly Pächt. In many old descriptions, Pächt also has one large foot, sometimes a goose foot or a swan foot. And Grimm thought the strange foot symbolized her being a higher being who could shapeshift into animal form. In the Tyrol, she also appears as a little old woman with a very wrinkled face, bright, lively eyes, and a long, hooked nose, and her hair is disheveled, her garments are tattered and torn. And like Bifana, Pächter is also a gift bringer. because originally Perta was the upholder of cultural taboos, such as the prohibition against spinning on holidays. And in the folklore of Bavarian Austria, where I come from, Perta was said to roam the countryside at midwinter, and she entered homes during the 12 days of Christmas between Christmas and Epiphany, especially on the 12th night, which is Epiphany. So, and she knows whether the children and the young servants of the household had behaved well and worked hard. And if they did, they found a small silver coin on the next day in either a shoe or a pail. And if they had not, she would slit their bellies open, remove stomach and guts, and stuff the hole with straw and pebbles. Hey!
Wow.
I mean,
this
that's
is not where I saw this going.
Well, see, we are in Austria here. So this is how we do it, right? So this is the country where Krampus comes from. This is our, this is the legends we grew up with, right? So
what I think is really funny about this is, so we have the fairy tales where it's always, you know, spinning straw into gold, or, you know, spinning flax into gold. But I love this connection with, like, you have to do your spinning, you have to be good, or, you know, you have to have done all of your spinning. Otherwise, I'm going to fill your belly, I'm going to slit you open, and I'm going to fill your belly with straw and pebbles, bitches.
Yes. So, and Perta was also particularly concerned to see that girls had spun the whole of their allotted portion of flax or wool during the year. And she would also slit people's bellies open and stuff them with straw if they ate something on the night of her feast day, other than the traditional meal of fish and gruel. So now the cult of Perta, under which followers left food and drink for Frau Pert and her followers in the hope of receiving wealth and abundance, was also condemned in Bavaria. For example, in the Teserus Pauperum in 1468, or by Thomas Ibendorfer von Haselbach in Die Dicem Preceptis, 1439. And later canonical and church documents characterized Perta as synonymous with other leading female spirits like Holda, Diana, Herodias, Ritella, and Abundia. And those of you listening who live in Austria might notice the similarity between Perta and Percht. So Percht is a Krampus-like figure, and there's still a tradition concerning Schirrperchten in Austria. So Schönperchten, so the depiction of Perta as like a beautiful woman, that's not really something that happens anymore, but we have Schirrperchten. Now, the word Perchten is plural for Perta, and it has become the name of Perta's entourage, so and as well as the name of the animal masks worn in parades and festivals in mountainous regions in Austria. And in the 16th century, as I said, Perchten took two forms, but the Schirrperchten are still kind of celebrated today. They have fangs, they have tusks, they have horse tails, and originally they were thought to drive out demons and ghosts. Now today, and that also happened already in the 16th century, men dress as ugly Perchten, and in the 16th century they went from house to house driving out bad spirits. But today they are kind of, usually what happens is the thing called Perchtenlauf, which is very similar to the Krampuslauf, where, and I think today, like, the Perchtenlauf and Krampuslauf are sometimes used synonymously. So usually young men dress up in those ugly costumes with, like, devil-like, demon-like dresses and, like, yeah. And they make parades where they kind of walk through the village or something. So it's still very much a tradition. But what few people know is that it actually refers back to Perta, a female goddess. Now that I have mentioned Perta, we also need to talk about the figure of Frau Holle, or Hulda, or Spielerholde, or Holda, or whatever names she might have. Because in Germanic pre-Christian folklore, Hulda, Hulda, Holle, Holla, were all names to denote a single being, and that being also incorporated ideas of the Pachter.
My students read this fairy tale this semester, and it was not what they were expecting from a fairy tale. They expect like really happy endings and things going great at the end, and they were like, this is not what we wanted from the story.
I'm gonna come to the Grimm's version of the legend or the myth later, but Holle basically was the goddess to whom children who die as infants go, and she's also known as the Dunkle Großmutter, which is the dark grandmother, and the Weiße Frau, the white lady. And those are elements that are also associated with the Grimm's fairy tale and her connection with the spirit world through the magic of spinning and weaving. So again, we have the theme of spinning and weaving here, has associated her with witchcraft in Catholic Germanic folklore. And apparently for Holle is one of Germany's and I would say Austria's most popular and durable female legendary figures. And she kind of represents a pre-Christian deity who survived in popular belief and in the memory of many people well into the 19th century. And I would argue up until today, she's a very famous figure, although today maybe just in the form of the Grimm's version of her. So in Germanic legends, Frau Holle, Holda, whatever she's called, is also the protectress of agriculture and women's crafts. Frau Holda's festival is in the middle of winter, during the 12 days of Christmas. And so Jakob Grimm himself also argued that Frau Holda was a Germanic goddess. So she, as I said, she was associated with witchcraft in Catholic Germanic folklore. She was considered to ride with witches and distaffs. I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, but it's an item that closely resembles the brooms that witches were thought to ride. So again, we have this witchcraft, this witchy kind of figure that, this witchy female figure, like that all of a sudden comes up in December. So this is a theme that repeats itself.
This is fantastic. Witches in winter, I'm all for it.
Holda is often also identified with Diana in old church documents. And as early as the beginning of the 11th century, she appears to have been known as the leader of women and female nocturnal spirits. Yay. So these women would leave the houses in spirit, going out through closed doors in the silence of the night, leaving the sleeping husbands behind. Can you imagine? And then they travel vast distances through the sky to great feasts or to battles among the clouds. Holda figures in some pre-Christian Alpine traditions that have survived to modern times. So during the Christmas period in the Alpine regions of Germany, Austria, and northern Switzerland, as I said, wild masked processions are still held in a number of towns impersonating Holda or Pachter or related beings and the wild hunt. So, Pachter and Holda are very much related. It's very difficult to differentiate those two, actually. And the most famous account of Holda is, of course, the Brothers Grimm, Frau Holle, or Mother Holda. Another manifestation of Frau Holle is the Spiller Holle. The Spiller Holle is an old woman wearing ragged clothes, sometimes referred to as a hag. Again, we have a witch-like figure. The Bohemian Frau Holle is a small and ugly woman which carries a bag of stinging nettles. And as I said, Spiller Holle and Frau Holle too are also basically two manifestations of the same figure. Again, the main activity of the Spiller Holle is connected with spinning. She's the overseer of spinning taboos and kind of also a boogeyman. The appearance of Spiller Holle is mainly during the winter months, especially during Advent, which is from like the four weeks before Christmas. And she goes from house to house to see if the children and spinsters are spinning diligently. She's looking through the windows or even gaps in the house walls. And when they are spinning during evening and night, there are punishments that can be slight or severe. Also, when spinsters aren't finished with the spinning, she will sit in their lap during spinning or even give them igneous spindles instead of normal ones. And the Spillerholzer takes lazy spinsters away. Which is also something that the Krampus later does. There's also the idea that he takes lazy or bad children away. Frau Holle beats them with a batch of stinging nettles. And if the tower is already spun, then there will be no punishment, and one of the nettles will be left in the house to ward the house of misfortune for the whole coming year. So, and then in Bohemia, spinning was also banned on the night of St. Thomas, and if a spinster is working anyway, she's punished by Frau Holle. So you maybe know Frau Holle by the Brothers Grimm, and I'm going to read a short version of the tale to you. So the Grimm's version of the tale goes like this. A rich widow lives with her daughter and her stepdaughter. The widow favoured her biological daughter, allowing her to become spoiled and idle, while her stepdaughter was left to do all the work. Every day the stepdaughter would sit outside the cottage and spin beside the well. One day she pricked her finger on the point of the spindle. Leaning over the well to wash the blood away, the spindle fell from her hand and sank out of sight. The stepdaughter feared that she would be punished for losing the spindle, and in a panic she leapt into the well after the spindle. Then the girl found herself in a meadow where she came upon an oven full of bread. The bread asked to be taken out before it burned. She took a baker's peel and took out all the loaves and then walked on. Then she came to an apple tree that asked that its apples be harvested, and she did that, and she gathered them into a pile before continuing on her way. And then finally she comes to a small house of an old woman who offers to allow the girl to stay if she would help with the housework. The woman then identifies herself as Frau Holle and cautions the girl to shake the feather bed pillows and cover it well when she makes the bed, as that would make it snow in the girl's world. The girl agrees to take service with Frau Holle and takes care to always shake the feather bed until the feathers flow about like snowflakes. After a time, the girl becomes homesick and she tells Frau Holle that it's time for her to return home. So Frau Holle is so impressed by the girl's kindness and hard work that when she escorts the girl to the gate, a shower of gold falls upon the girl. And she also gives her the spindle which had fallen into the well and that she jumped after. The gate closes, the girl finds herself back not far from her own house, from her mother's house. So, her mother wishes the same fortune for her own daughter, and she also sits by the well, the other daughter, and spins, but the girl deliberately throws the spindle into the well, and then she jumps in herself. She comes to the oven, she doesn't assist the bread, she comes to the apple tree, she doesn't help the apples, and then she comes to Frau Holle, takes service there, but before long falls into her lazy, careless ways, and Frau Holle soon dismisses her, and as the lazy girl stands by the gate, a kettle of pitch spills over her, and Frau Holle tells her that's what she has earned, and the gate closes.
So she basically gets tarred and feathered, which is amazing.
Yeah, and then there are other versions that also describe the first girl having a piece of gold fall from her lips every time she speaks, whilst the second has a toad fall from her lips every time she speaks.
Yeah. Also amazing. And
so that's a very short summary of the Grimm's version. And the funny thing is, I, as a child, still grew up with the saying that Frau Holle is making her bed when it snows, so... It's still something that's said to children. So she's kind of still depicted as kind of the woman that makes snowfall.
Which is also kind of a creepy warning, though. It's also a warning of, like, yeah. Frau Holle's still there, and you better be good, otherwise you're going to get covered in tar.
Yeah. Yeah, and I already said that I grew up in Austria, and that's why I did not grow up with Santa Claus, but with Christkind. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. So Christkind brings presents on the evening of the 24th of December, which is the last day of Advent. So in Austria and in neighboring countries, Christmas is celebrated on the 24th. And Christkind is usually depicted as an angelic, female, or gender non-specific childlike figure. And sometimes at kind of celebration, she's played by humans, and then usually she's played by a young woman. But I have discussions with friends every...
Okay, I enjoy that you just said she's played by humans. Like, who else would play her in a celebration? Mm-hmm. Do you have aliens?
No, I meant when she's played by a human, she's played by young women usually with, like, blonde hair and everything. No, we don't import aliens to Austria just for that. That would be...
I'm just checking.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that would be very... that would not be very economic. I think that would cost a lot of money. And it's also maybe impossible. I don't know. So I have discussions with friends every Christmas because it's never specified whether Christmas, the legendary... Whether Christkind, the legendary figure, is a girl or whether... it's gender non-specific, and there are people who think it's just gender non-specific, and there are people who think it's a girl.
Well, I mean, because kind is neutral, it doesn't really, it's like gender neutral.
Yeah, and also because of the way that it's depicted, so it's not really, you can't really tell. So she's, Christkind is dressed in white or white and gold. It has blonde hair, golden hair, or golden hair and wings, like an angel. And the interesting thing is that despite the fact that Christkind is either female or gender non-specific, it's orange and obviously it's Jesus as a baby. So Christ means Christ and kind means child. So it's basically Christ child. And yeah, what usually happens in Austria is that one of the grown-ups in the family rings a bell and then the children go to the Christmas tree to find the candles lit up and all the presents under the tree. And children are never allowed to see the Christkind in person. What's also interesting is that the Christkind is actually a Protestant tradition, despite the fact that it's celebrated in Catholic countries like Austria. And Santa Claus is a Catholic figure, despite the fact that many regions he's celebrated in are Protestant. Because the Christkind was created during Reformation in 16th and 17th century Europe, when Martin Luther wanted to de-emphasize the previous Catholic celebration of Saint Nicholas. And this was because he didn't want a Catholic saint bringing Protestant children their gifts. And he also considered it to be blasphemy to idolize saints rather than Jesus himself. So Christkind turned into the Christmas gift bringer in Austria, in Switzerland, in Germany, in the Czech Republic, in Slovenia, Croatia, some parts of Italy, and so on and so forth.
What's really interesting about Christkind is that, I mean, it is depicted like an angel, and angels are also gender non-specific.
Exactly,
I mean, they are genderless as well, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as a child, I always considered the Christkind to be genderless, basically. For me, Christkind was genderless. It's just that, you know, when it's played by a human character, it's usually a young woman. But yeah. And it's interesting that there is this genderless being that brings gifts at Christmas, I think, other than the fat old man that you have.
Yeah, sure. Don't knock the fat old man, though. I mean, I'll take the gifts wherever I can get them.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about Norse mythology. So we're going to go back in time a little more than what Beatrice has been doing here, at least in the last section there. But I'm going to start the conversation with the goddess and giantess Skadi. She lived in the high areas of the mountains in Scandinavia, where the snow never melted. She was married for a time to a god named Njord, who lived by the sea. But they ended up parting ways because he didn't care for where she preferred to live because it was a little too cold and desolate for his tastes. And she didn't like where he lived on the seashore because it was too loud and I would assume too bright and probably a little warmer than what she was used to. So according to author Mary Zeiss Stange in her book Woman the Hunter, Skadi was a goddess of winter. She was a mother of the north, the Dark One. Stange points out that Skadi was a goddess known for her hunting prowess, her love of snowstorms that she herself could create, and a knack for seeking out those too young or frail to survive the winter by shooting them in the heart and ending their misery in the cold winters of the north. But she wasn't feared and she was not hated. The Norsemen knew that life was fragile and that death was to be expected, especially in the harsh regions in which they lived. I mean, they knew that it was tough to live there, so I'm sure that it sucked to lose family members, but I think that they had a pretty realistic idea of the likelihood of those things. But yes, so Skadi, however, was turned by the Christians into a malevolent being known later as the Snow or Ice Queen. So think of Elsa from Frozen, but without the happy Disney-fied ending.
Or without the happy Disney-fied middle part or beginning. None of the Disney-fied parts.
Right, that's true.
So Elsa's Snow Queen comes from Hans Christian Andersen's Snow Queen, which is based on those Nordic.
He took that from Skadi. But yeah, so nice. I thought she was worth mentioning at this point of the year.
Mm.
Who doesn't watch Frozen, especially if they have kids? All the freaking time.
I love Frozen, and I don't even have children.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, it's a good movie and everything, but not 12 times in 12 days.
Is it still going on, though?
No, DVDs, my friend, DVDs.
Yes, or Netflix
but,
or something.
But Heather, are they still watching it? I thought the hype is over.
No.
It's never over, no, okay.
It's never.
I get it.
It's never over. For a while, Moana was the thing, and now my 2-year-old has discovered Frozen, and so now it's Frozen and Anna and Elsa. And
okay.
Yeah.
But probably there's a new Disney film coming out soon, and then...
Sure.
Hopefully it's good, and then you'll be rid of
live action
Frozen.
Mulan.
I'm sure it'll be great. I don't have an issue with Disney movies. Mm. I love them. Yeah. It's just, I mean, I prefer Moana over, anyway, well, I prefer Tamatoa and Jemaine from Flight of the Conchords is what I prefer.
I think my favorite is Brave.
Okay, so keeping in line with Norse mythology and all the things revolving around the winter solstice, we have the goddess Frigg, which Beatrice mentioned earlier in the intro. Her son, Balder, was slain by his blind brother due to the meddling of Loki. I don't know if you've heard about this Loki character.
I am familiar with Loki.
So Balder, I believe he was called Balder the Beautiful. He was a beloved deity, and at some point, nightmares started to come to him and his mother, foretelling of his death. Well, obviously, they did not care for this, so Frigg made certain to get every object on Earth to swear that they would do no harm against her son. All objects, that is, except the mistletoe plant, which Frigg assumed was too young to swear loyalty and therefore too young to actually be threatening to her son. Loki, of course, being the trickster that he is, discovered this loophole because he disguised himself and got Frigg to spill some information about the goings-on at the time. And once he knew that mistletoe would be Baldur's weakness, he made sure to find some mistletoe that he could use to spear Balder and ultimately cause his death. Now, Loki created the spear out of the mistletoe branch, although some traditions say it was an arrow. It's kind of irrelevant, I think, which it was. But there was a party that was going on where the gods and goddesses were trying in jest to injure Balder because they knew that he could not be injured. This was pure entertainment for them. They were throwing rocks and, I don't know, just trying to hurt him, and it wasn't happening. So Loki brought the mistletoe weapon and saw Baldur's brother, again, I mentioned that he was blind, Hodur, who was sitting out of the festivities because he felt that he was unable to participate in the games. He couldn't see his brother to throw whatever he wanted to throw at him. So he was just kind of sitting off to the side, and Loki comes in and said, "Hey, if you want to have a good laugh about this and you want to participate, I happen to have a weapon here and I can kind of tell you, you know, direct you which way to throw."
Loki's such a dick.
Yeah. And so Hodur said, "Okay." And Loki gave him the direction. The spear was thrown and Baldur was killed.
It's interesting. This reminds me of the Siegfried saga stuff, too, where, like, Siegfried is invincible because he was bathed in dragon's blood except for, like, a leaf that was put on his back. And then someone eventually tells, like, whomever, like, what the weakness is, and he ends up getting killed, like the Achilles heel. Like
Achilles
whatever.
In his heel, yeah. Yeah. So there's far more to the story about how the gods and goddesses wanted to get Baldur back from hell. But that didn't happen. Again, thanks to Loki, who I think the story goes that he was disguised as some sort of troll or something, and they needed everybody to swear that they would cry because they missed Baldur. And of course, they didn't know this was Loki, but this particular creature said, no, I won't do it. And so Baldur wasn't allowed to be released from Hell, at least until Ragnarok, which I think is interesting because the whole myth here is a mirror of what the Norse idea of Ragnarok is. And I think, again, going back to the realistic expectations that the Norsemen had at the time, I think it's a bit of an idea that brought comfort to those who believed, or even currently follow, these myths, that Baldur's death was symbolic of the end, but just as with any cycle, there is rebirth, right? So Frigg lost her son, and that was a horrible time. It was a dark and desolate time, like the winter months that we know, but he would return, just like life does in the spring, just like what is promised of Ragnarok. Death is inevitable, but it's just a stage leading to new beginnings. So this myth is pertinent to this time of year. You know, Baldur's death, like I said, was symbolic of a few things, but one of those being the onset of winter, the death of all things beautiful in anticipation of an eventual resurrection and renewal that will come at a later time. And I think this is a theme that's cross-cultural, you know? I want to bring us back to Frigg right now. So according to a website that I found, which outlines mistletoe lore,
ooh,
which this, of course, is what Beatrice was talking about, the white berries seen on mistletoe are due to Frigg's tears.
Mm-hmm.
Some traditions decree that the mistletoe was declared a symbol of peace and friendship by Frigg after the horrible accidental death of her dear Baldur. So in this way, the mistletoe becomes safe, and those under it will be blessed with a kiss, essentially replacing despair with love.
Oh, okay.
That's nice. But I will say, if you go to a Christmas party, don't trick someone into going under the mistletoe and kissing them, because that's inappropriate.
Consent, ladies and gentlemen. Consent also needs to happen at Christmas.
Yeah, no consent there, people. So aside from the symbolism of this time period, I think it's important to mention that this time of year is when Yule is celebrated. So today, the time frame of Yule varies depending on who is celebrating, but in general, it revolves around the time of the winter solstice, which is the 21st this year, I believe, and continues for about 12 days. This is an ancient time of celebration, though, and we know from historical sources that the ancient pagan tradition was one that revolved around sacrifices, feasts, and fantastic drinking.
Fantastic drinking to dull the pain of the holiday.
Yes.
We really don't know much detail about how the Scandinavians or the Anglo-Saxon pagans celebrated everything during this time of year, but there is a reference to what we now know as Christmas Eve being a sacred day known as Modronicht, or Mother's Night, which was probably associated with the cult of the mother and matrons. They're female goddesses who, of course, were associated with fertility and childbirth. I'm not going to get into detail with them now, but I encourage you to look it up because it's pretty interesting. Yeah, so borrowing from a fantastic website that obviously will be linked in the show notes, it's called www.revivingherstory.com. There's a discussion of celebrations of the feminine around the time of the winter solstice that are covered in detail, and much to my delight, they are thoroughly cited. And there's a section that I would like to quote here. So the quote is as follows. Quote. The very fact that Christmas is celebrated on December 25th may have been borrowed from pagan traditions. In addition to the more well-known celebration of Saturnalia, winter festivals included Yule, a celebration of the children born after Mother's Night, and Kolyada, a celebration of the sun goddess Kolyada. Disablot, the midwinter festival honoring the Disir, which are the spirits of female ancestors, was a private celebration for family and friends, much like today's Christmas. End quote. So just in that little snippet, we see how there were all of these celebrations, multiple celebrations, around this time of year. And this naturally lends itself to the discussion of how Christianity ultimately absorbed many pagan traditions in an effort to Christianize the pagan communities way back in the day. But yeah, so I know that there's many other female goddesses associated with the season of winter and whose stories revolve around the winter solstice and the new year. But this time around, I was inspired to look into some Norse mythology a bit of a departure from my classical academic roots, but I kind of wanted to look into my actual genetic roots for this episode. And also, it's probably a good time to mention that I did not have a ton of time to look into a bunch of other things because, as is also with the Christmas season, are many viral and bacterial illnesses that, yes, that delayed this recording.
We have all been hit by plagues of various sorts.
Exactly, which is the reason why my voice sounds like that today.
Yeah, that delayed this recording by like 3 weeks and that my children are currently fighting off for the second week in a row. From scarlet fever to fevers of 103, almost 104, and multiple doctor's trips. It's been fantastic, guys.
Another reason not to kiss under the mistletoe.
Yeah, yeah, please don't spread these things.
Right.
Don't spread the illnesses, guys. Yeah.
Well, then let's hope that Frohole blesses us with many gifts this Christmas, not just diseases. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Liz? Heather, say something.
I mean, I feel like we often have lessons learned at the end of our episodes. So I think that for this episode, my lesson learned would be to stop celebrating the fat man in the red suit and instead pick your favorite winter Christmas epiphany goddess and female figure from European tradition or other traditions. I'm sure there are others. And celebrate her instead.
Yeah, or just acknowledge that there were other beings prior to Santa Claus or even the figure of Christ and just enjoy the holiday for being with people, I guess. An excuse to be with family and try not to fight, people. Try not to fight with your family.
And if you do, just drink some alcohol.
Yes, drink because Liz told you to.
Yes, well, I mean, drink alcohol if you know that it makes you happier. If you have issues with alcohol, please do not drink because Liz told you to.
And if you don't want to drink alcohol, it's the Christmas season for chocolate as well. So
eat that chocolate. Eat cookies. Eat all the food.
Stay warm if it's cold.
Stay warm and stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to work for fair and equal pay.
Hey!
Bye!
Bye.
So we're taking a bit of time off for the holidays, although if everything goes accordingly, we will have an episode to you right after the new year. But we just wanted to say we hope you enjoyed this year with the She Who Persisted podcast. We hope that you have a great new year, and we'll see you in 2018. Bye.